Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, it's music from the band OK Go in conversation with one of the founding members, Damian Kulash. OK Go may possibly be better known for their videos than for the music for which they accompany, and they're currently on a tour which brings elements of the video and the videos themselves to the stage. They'll be in Rancho Cucamonga soon. First, though, Dodie Stevens. She had a brief career as a teen singer, then thankfully returned to the stage after a short hiatus and is still performing today. She'll be in the area soon as part of Legends of the 60s Volume 3. We'll have details on the concert up in just a bit, but first, the one that got it all going, recorded when she was only 12.
His name is Dooley. He's my guy and I love him truly. He's not good looking, heaven knows, but I'm wild about his crazy clothes. He wears tan shoes with pink shoelaces, a polka dot vest, and man oh man, he wears tan shoes with pink shoelaces and a big Panama with a purple hat band.
That was it.
I just read that you were maybe one day shy of turning 13 when this came out. Is that fact or fiction there?
Yeah, no, that's true, as I recollect. I know that I was 12 when I actually recorded it. It was like at the end of 1958, and I turned 13 in February of 1959. So it was just a couple of months earlier when I recorded it, and then it was released a day before my birthday.
Talk about what a birthday present. That's,
I know.
That's nice.
And I was surprised because I didn't really think that it would be a hit.
Well, you know, it's a fun song. It's a cute song, I have to say as well. It goes beyond fun. It is cute, especially with this video that folks can find. One can easily track it down if you go YouTubing for a bit.
I know, yeah. The one that I did, it was the Pat Boone Show.
I wondered if that was that, yeah.
That scene and me singing the song on his television show came from.
So to set that up for folks who have not seen it yet, and hopefully they won't leave the interview to go watch it, but they'll wait till afterwards, but it shows you kind of wandering around your room as you're chatting on the telephone and pink shoelaces being the conversation. Was that improvised? Was it choreographed at all? Maybe a little bit of both?
I think it was a little bit of both. You know, Tim, well, at this point, lay down in your bed, you know, on your stomach with your feet up, you know, that kind of thing. I think that kind of stuff went down as far as directing it. And the rest of it was pretty much left up to me because I was very creative as a youngster and those things came naturally to me.
Sure. Having to act like you're wandering around the room talking on the telephone, that would not be hard for a 12 or 13-year-old.
Oh, yeah, not at all. That's what I did at home.
Hat band. This tune, it was given to you, and I believe this was given to you by the same guy who changed you from Geraldine Ann Pasquale to Dodie Stevens. Can we talk about that?
True. Carl Burns, who was the president of Crystal Light Records, had signed me to his label and found Pink Shoelaces. And he was talking to Johnny Grant. They were having drinks at a place called, I think it was Martoni's in Hollywood. And he was telling him that he had just signed this young girl to his label, and he was looking for a stage name because my name was Geraldine Ann Pasquale. And the person that he was talking to, Johnny Grant, at the time was a DJ in Hollywood. And later on, he became the mayor of Hollywood. But at the time, in 1959, he was a DJ. And so the two of them were kicking around some ideas for names, and they both agreed to Stevens being my last name because it was cute and it was short and it was easy to remember. The first name was a little bit of a quandary. They had three names that they were looking at, first names. One was Carol. The other one was Carmen. And then the third one was Dodie. And they agreed to Dodie because it was cute. And for a 12, 13-year-old, that was a cute name as opposed to Carmen. Carol would have been good. I think I preferred Carol, but there was already a Carol Stevens at the time.
Right. I think we had Connie Stevens out there at some point
as well. Yes, we had Connie. Connie was out there. and I don't remember what other Stevens were out there, but that's how I was dubbed with that name.
Okay. Well, there were no Dodies, that's for sure.
I know that. I'll tell you what, there was a comedian, a female comedian. Her name was Dodie Goodman, and that was the only other Dodie that was out at the time, and she was a much older woman, and she was a comedian.
I understand that Carl, the president of Crystalette Records that you just mentioned, he had seen you in a local show called Strictly Informal. What was Strictly Informal?
Strictly Informal was a local television show out of L.A. It was just introducing the audience to people that were in their community that were doing something of importance. And it was a variety show, so different folks were on the show. And I also believe it had a lot to do with people in music being on the show, because Vic Dana, who was signed to Crystalette Records, was on the show, and Carl Burns was watching the show to see his artist perform his latest release and saw me on the same show.
Nice.
So
okay.
It was a result of him watching it to see Vic Dana, his artist, and happened to see me doing, and I don't remember what song I was singing. I have no idea what it was, but he saw me and he heard me, and that's when he contacted the television station and asked to talk to somebody in regards to me.
That's really cool.
That's how that happened, yeah.
And even before that, just jumping back a hair, back to the, jumping back earlier than age 12.
Well, I started with voice lessons at the age of 5.
Okay.
And as a result of that, my vocal coach, I had a few of them actually, but the one that was most instrumental was a woman by the name of Helen Bishop. She had some connections with some of the TV stations and also some fundraisers that were going on. And she was so impressed with me as her student that she thought I was good enough to go on these TV shows, or I was good enough to, I remember doing quite a few fundraisers for the City of Hope that she and her husband were involved in. And so she would get me on the show and I would sing my songs. I mean, I just kept singing. I would do competition shows and just whatever was out there for me to show my talents. And she was very instrumental in getting that to happen.
Even before your performance with Pink Shoelaces at the tender age of 12, at 8, weren't you even on Art Linkletter's house party TV show with a song, Merry Go, Merry Go Round?
That was it. Yes, I was. I was on his show singing that song, and I was on the Frankie Lane show.
Oh, wow.
Also around the same time, he had a weekly show that was going on and had me on his show a couple of times, and I was 8.
Wow.
I know.
So many people think about, you do your career, your hits make it or they don't, and some folks will think about what kind of job they might have to go back to. In your case, you might only have to think about, well, 9th or 10th grade, maybe, if that were the thing to return to. So you did Pink Shoelaces, and that was such a huge one, although
yeah, I
read that it started on the charts somewhere around 96 or so, so, you know, way, way down there, but it eventually reached number 3. Were you aware of it at the point when it was at 96 and you were thinking, oh gosh, this is going nowhere, and then you slowly saw it climb? How did that come about as far as...
I don't remember.
Okay.
All I remember was that I was surprised that it was on the charts at all. That much I remember.
Okay.
As far as maybe watching it climb,
sure,
I don't
sure.
have any recollection of just that. Wow, this is on the charts.
Mm. Nice.
Wow. And then it was on top 40. Oh, my God, really? And then it's like in the top 10. Well, yeah. I guess that must have been pretty amazing to me. I don't know how it couldn't.
Really?
Mary Jones, Jonesy Jones, little Angie's Ivy.
Dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kiddie divey too, wouldn't you? Yes, mazy dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kiddie divey too, wouldn't you?
Dot Records then signed you to a recording contract. A song called Merzydotes, a very funny spelling. If folks don't know Merzydotes, the line, for example, would be Merzydotes and Dozydotes and Little Lambsy. Now, the thing is, though, you have to say it slowly or enunciate it differently, as in mares eat oats.
Oats and does eat oats. And little lambs eat ivy.
Yes. But it comes out, mares eat oats, does eat oats, and little lambs eat ivy.
And little lambs eat ivy. And, of course, they were capitalizing on the novelty of the song and the words and all that because they wanted to keep it in line with pink shoelaces. Then they did something, David, that I thought was very odd. At the time, I didn't think it was odd. I thought it was wonderful because, as I said earlier, I had been trained in voice since the age of five, and it was weekly lessons for years and years as a child. So I had a very mature voice, and when Dot Records discovered that I had a voice beyond the novelty that Pink Shoelaces was, they wanted to capitalize on that. So I released an album of all ballads from the 40s, standards.
Oh,
that was my first album.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I know. Kids didn't want to hear that.
No.
Maybe their parents, but their parents wouldn't be buying songs that were recorded by a teenager. Somebody missed the mark big time. Then the follow-up to that first album with all those standards was Over the Rainbow, which was all of Judy Garland's songs.
Yeah.
Well, granted, I had the voice that could cover all those songs very, very well because of my training. Once again, my fans didn't want to hear that.
No.
You know, the third album, go figure, had Pink Shoelaces on it with all the songs from my generation, you know, that era of the 50s and 60s, which that should have been the first album out of the chute.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Dodie Stevens, part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s, Volume 3. That's coming up November 16th, along with The Modern Gentleman, Brian Hyland, Paul and Paula, Bobby Rydell, Jimmy Clanton, and emceed by Wink Martindale. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org.
Don't you understand English? No.
There's a lot of hugging I gotta do.
And oh no.
And I wanna do my hugging with you.
Please let me.
So this is when we were getting things like Miss Lonely Hearts or maybe Poor Butterfly.
Exactly.
No, the song No. Let's address No
for just a little bit of a novelty. That wasn't so much in the vein of standards and ballads. No, it was.
No.
In fact, I liked No. I thought it was really cute. It was a cute song.
It is a cute tune, and if people don't know it, it's quite simply someone begging you, I mean begging you, for a kiss or a hug or anything.
Yeah.
While it is a really cute song, once again with you, it ends with, and this just wouldn't fly very well today in many circles.
But, yeah, I know exactly what you're going to say.
Yep.
A girl means yes when she says no.
Yes.
Oh, God, are you kidding me?
Yes.
I'd be tarred and feathered if I were to say something like that, or anybody would say something like that now, because it's absolutely not true.
Oh, yeah.
But then it was cute, and it was innocent, and, you know, there was so much innocence back then, but certainly not now.
Yeah, the first time I heard it, I was just really listening to the song, because, again, it's a cute song. But then we get to that line, I was like, oh, wow, what
I know now, absolutely. Yeah. Back then, oh, it was just, oh, look how cute, how funny, oh.
Don't
you
know that a girl means yes when she says no?
Got another number I'm gonna call.
And oh, no.
In an hour I'll be having a ball.
Don't let go.
Guess I'll stay here after all.
When I say no. Don't let go.
Let me see. I think I've covered everything, but I better read it through just once more.
Miss Lonely Heart.
Miss Lonely Hearts, I'm writing this letter to you, 'cause you're so wise, so please advise this sad little girl what to do.
Another one that we just mentioned, Miss Lonely Hearts. It's a pretty little breakup song, is just my notes for it. That may be a diminutive, I suppose, but it's a nice one, and it's sort of a doo-wop style. And the thing about it that I really noted, it's uniquely delivered as if in a letter to a Dear Abby type of person. That is,
yeah,
Miss Lonely
Hearts.
Yeah,
I think that's what it was based on.
And again, these were songs that staff songwriters for whatever label that you were at the point, they would be bringing these songs to you. Did you have any choice in them, or were they pretty much assigned at your age?
They were assigned to me.
Okay.
And also back then, writers would just submit their songs through the mail. They would just send it to the record company and hope that they could have an artist on their label record it. And there were, of course, way more that were discarded than the ones that were sent in and submitted to me.
Yeah.
Miss Lonely Hearts, we'll be sweethearts again.
In addition to your music, you starred with Fabian in your first film. My God, talk about diving into the deep end.
Yeah, I know. And, well, they were capitalizing on both Fabian's stardom and my stardom, and both of us being on the charts, being a teen idol. They thought pairing us together in his first motion picture, and then, of course, my first motion picture was a fabulous thing to do.
Yeah.
So that's what they did. Even though him being 16 and me being only 13, for the movie it really didn't matter. We were young people in the movie, and that's all there was to that.
Right.
But as I said, he was 16, I was 13. There's no way that he would have been interested in a 13-year-old. Now, a 13-year-old being interested in a 16-year-old cute boy like he was, absolutely. I was like every other teenage girl that was out there. So it was good enough for me to play his girlfriend in the movie. That was a dream come true.
I actually watched not Hound Dog Man in its entirety, but I watched the clip. It's sort of a barn, well, not a true traditional barn dance, but a dance and performance in a barn.
Yeah, it was.
And Fabian is up there singing, talking about the girl with the green eyes, and you have kind of a swish and sway and look up at him every so often, and I thought, oh my God, is this all it's going to be? But then he has kind of a moody moment and leaves the area, and you get up there to start singing.
You want to really know about that scene?
I do.
So that swishy look that I was giving him every now and then,
yep.
And then he had kind of a moody thing, and then he just stormed off the stage, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It was because I was trying to make him jealous, and I was dancing with some other dude on the dance floor, and he saw that, and I was like, you know, looking up at him like, well, look, I've got him. You know, and he wants me. It was my way of making him jealous. And so then he storms off the stage, and he goes and he gets drunk. I don't know, some kind of corn whiskey or whatever they had back then, and he gets drunk because he was so upset that there was another man in my life. And then after that, of course, we came together, and life was good, and everybody was happy. That's what that scene was all about, was me making him jealous.
Beyond being with Fabian in Hound Dog Man, you also co-starred with Frankie Avalon. This is an animated feature film, Alakazam the Great. I have yet to track this one down. Can you say anything about
that? Oh, yeah, it was a cute little animated feature film. Alakazam was a monkey, and he was this hero monkey that was saving this and that and everyone else. And I played his girlfriend monkey, Didi. And it wasn't my voiceover as far as speaking all the lines. I just sang a song or two in the movie as Dee Dee the monkey.
Okay.
So that was that.
Really cute there. And I guess going beyond the teen idol, you ended up with Ben Gazzara in another one, Convicts 4.
That was just a cameo role. And there were many, many really big stars that were in that movie that just had one scene or something of that sort. And I was one of them. I felt so privileged to be part of all these really wonderful stars. and I had my cameo role. Just one scene, and that was that. I played Ben Gazzara's sister. He was the star of the movie, and I was his sister, and I went with my mother and father to visit him in prison, and that's where the scene takes place.
Convicts 4. You ended up leaving music briefly, and we won't dwell on this much, I assure you, but you got married at the age of 16 and went off to Missouri?
It was Missouri. I call it Misery.
Oh, gosh.
I just a little slant on the name. Sure. Not that I'm putting it down, but, you know, it was my choice to go there. It was my choice to get out of the business. It was just too much. It was very demanding for a teenager. I wanted to be like my peers. I wanted to do what they were doing. I wanted to be a teenager. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be famous. I didn't want people to stop me on the street or point at me because they recognized me. Or I just wanted to be a teenager. And everybody at that time was getting out of high school, marrying their high school sweetheart, and starting a family. And so I went, yeah, I want to do that. I'm done with singing. It was very easy for me to do that because my husband at the time, his parents were very involved in a religious situation, a religious church, and that particular religion was preaching that show business was of the devil.
Oh.
Not music, because they sang in church, but only gospel songs and that kind of thing. But show business was of the devil, so I had to remove myself from such a devilish way of life. I know, but when you're 16, 17 years old, you buy into that nonsense.
Oh, sure.
You buy into it. It's a very strong message, and all these people around you were having visions and rolling on the floor, and it was just something that I got caught up in. But that didn't last long. Well, long enough for it to get me out of show business, long enough for it to get me to Missouri, and then to have my daughter. So I look at those things. When something happens, something good can come out of it. And Stephanie, my daughter, was absolutely it. And if nothing else happened as a result of me quitting my career, moving to Missouri, if nothing else happened than giving birth to my beautiful daughter, then I say, okay, what a blessing. Then I turned it around. You know, she was 6 months old. I was 21, somewhere around there. And I went, well, this doesn't make sense anymore. So I just left Missouri, moved back to L.A. with my daughter under my arm, little sweet six-month-old, and tried to resume my career.
Well, now you have her on stage with you these days, which is really incredible.
Singing the audiences songs. Love it. Yeah. She's been singing with me in these doo-wop shows since the 90s when the resurgence of them started to come back.
Will she be out here in Ontario November 16th for this show?
She will be. We love doing these shows.
Dodie, somewhere on the side, I believe you and Stephanie formed a Southern rock band. That's AKA Stevens. Yes?
That was in the 90s, in the mid-90s is what I want to say. Yeah, it was great. We co-wrote all of our songs, and we opened for Toby Keith. That was like the biggest thing for us. And we had our one album, Outlaw of the Heart was the name of the album.
Yes.
It was great fun. It just didn't quite do what it was intended to do, that's all. Okay. And you know what, David? I think the reason was, at that time, the Judds were very, very big, and it was the mother and daughter act. And so I don't know if the audiences out there weren't ready for another mother and daughter act in the country field. We were nothing like them at all. AKA Stevens was nothing like what the Judds, the music was that they were doing, but I think it was just wrong timing.
All right.
That's all.
I would love for you to tell me about Affirm a Song, how it came to be.
I'm so glad you asked me.
Oh, yes.
It is still going on.
Good. Let's talk about how it came together.
It is my latest music project with Stephanie. I wrote all the songs for them, and what it is a motivational and inspirational concert. And we have a CD that we're just finishing up now. We've got one more session, which is going to be tomorrow, as a matter of fact.
Mm.
And we'll be mastering it and ready for it to be on a CD. But it's so close to my heart because, as I've lived all these years, I've seen what the world has become. I can't say that it's gotten better and better and better and better. There's still war. There's still people fighting against one another. There's still so much negative stuff out there that I thought it's time that at least I can do my part to put a little bit more positive stuff out into the world.
I am faithful, I am grateful, I'm protected, I'm respected, I am generous, I'm harmonious, I'm intelligent, I am brilliant. The power of I am is energy. What I say I am, I will be.
So as opposed to a lecture, I'm doing it in song form. Very, very positive messages in all of the songs. So this was just my way, affirm a song. And that's what it is, affirm a song. Because I've read so many self-help books over the years and gone to lectures, and it turned my life around. It changed me. But I didn't always remember what I read or the lecture that I heard that had such an impact. Certainly not after a few years, even a few months.
Wow.
So I went, for me, being a singer, I knew that if I turned it into a song, I would remember it. It was remembering lyrics to a song that I wanted to sing. So I thought, well, if that works for me, it'll work for other people. Music is very powerful. Music has been used in therapy. For years, it's been used that way. So I'm just using it as another tool. It's a self-help concert. And you'll remember it. You know, and that's what I did. I would read a chapter in a book, and I'd go, oh, I want to remember what I read. That was so powerful. And so I would take that chapter, and I would turn it into a song. And I would remember it that way. So this way, I didn't have to carry a book with me in the car, or if I was having a bad day, I didn't have to go to the book. Now, where did I read that? I was just, oh, yeah, this song. Oh, yeah, I remember. Worry and fear is a robber of time, stealing all my wonderful moments away, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Gosh.
Life is a game and not a battle. So many people battle it instead of using it as a game. So that's what Affirm a Song is about.
Music in conversation with Dodie Stevens. To start off this KVC Arts, she's part of the lineup with Legends of the 60s Volume 3 coming up November 16th in Ontario, along with The Modern Gentleman, Brian Hyland, Paul and Paula, Bobby Rydell, Jimmy Clanton, and emceed by Wink Martindale. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Coming up November 1st at the Lewis Family Playhouse, the band OK Go. Now, the band has gained much notoriety for their music videos, rightfully so, often low budget, but always complex. They could be driving through the desert, striking objects with a car, or items sticking out from the car in time and playing with the music. Later we'll hear about that one, as well as an incredibly large Rube Goldberg machine timed out to one of their videos. I spoke with Damian Kulash, one of the founders of the band, along with Tim Nordwind, somebody met at art school, but not quite what I'd thought.
Yeah, we went to a summer camp together when we were 11 years old, and then for several summers thereafter, and that's now, you know, 30-something years ago, so it's been a band a long time in the making.
Was it, by the way, at this summer camp with the instructor, this is the namesake for the band, the guy that always say, okay, go?
Yeah, he was our art teacher's assistant, and he had a peculiar smell, which we didn't recognize until we were old enough to know a little bit more about marijuana, and he would always give us these really, like, weird psychedelic instructions, like, you know, like, touch the paper and touch the still life with your mind and then draw the difference, and then make you sort of sit there waiting for a few minutes before he'd give you the, okay, go. And that was kind of his catchphrase. So it became the name of a band in a joke in junior high. And then, you know, a decade later when we were starting a real band, we were like, well, let's do that band. Let's be OK Go. And it's funny what a weird ride it's been, because, of course, we were making like little videos together when we were in junior high. And when we started the band and got signed to a major label and everything in the 90s, we did not know that our sort of extracurricular activities of making videos and sort of associated art projects could become a career. At the time, it was just bands sold CDs and got on the radio, and that's, you know, you made things for MTV. But those were made by, like, big famous directors and so forth. And we stumbled into this weird universe sort of by accident. We had a ridiculous dance routine we did on stage in the early aughts. It was like, you know, it was the era of the Strokes, and everybody was, like, super cool and kind of disaffected. And we wanted a way to do things in little indie clubs that would kind of break that kind of hipster veneer. So we would break into these ridiculous dances. We were just making fun of ourselves, obviously, but we were rehearsing one in my backyard. We made, a little rehearsal tape. And just something about the quality of that performance was so ridiculous and funny, and we sent it to a couple of friends online. It was the year before YouTube started, and it went viral. And next thing you know, like, we realized it was a music video. You know, it had never been intended as a video, but suddenly we had the most successful video we'd ever made. So if we've got this small group of internet nerd fans now that love this thing, well, you know, if we could make something for them by accident, why don't we make something for them on purpose? And that was Here It Goes Again, which was the treadmill video. And that's the one that really sort of exploded and suddenly bridged the gap between this kind of, like, weird homemade internet culture and MTV. And, you know, it got a Grammy and our lives changed, and suddenly we were filmmakers, and it was a lot of fun.
That video that we were speaking about, Here It Goes Again, the one with the treadmill routine, it must have cost dozens to produce. What is it, 6 or 8 treadmills, and you're just in a, is it somebody's garage? Is it a small warehouse space?
It's a ballroom behind my sister's house in Florida. My sister was a ballroom dancer at the time. Her name is Trish C, and she is now a film director as well. But at the time, she was a dancer, we were a rock band, and we were just making something ridiculous together. And once we realized that the thing we had made was sort of changing the way the music industry worked, and certainly become a kind of touchstone for a lot of internet advertising and the way people think about homemade stuff online, she started making more films as did we. So.
Nice, okay. And now with this one, did you actually have maybe an outside choreographer, or was this one or more of you thinking, okay, this would be cool, and then just sort of working the moves? Because it is tightly choreographed. It has to be for this. You can actually just look up OK Go treadmill and you'll get there too.
My sister was a dancer, of course, so we had a choreographer with us.
Oh, so, and she did it. Okay.
Yeah, we all did it together. We just moved to her house for 2 weeks. I mean, really, the only way you choreograph on treadmills is to hurl yourself at them and see what happens. And 90% of the time, that's injurious, but that other 10% of the time, you wind up with some really wonderful and unexpected thing. So we did that enough times to come up with a routine, and we filmed it, and we were done. And of course, in the 15 years since then, we've taken that to a much more elaborate level. A couple of years ago, we did one in zero gravity, where we were choreographed in one of those microgravity planes that flies in parabolas.
Yeah.
And we've done ones where we choreograph stuff in slow motion, and this led to a whole sort of investigation into how you make films as a musician, and it's been really, really fun.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org. I'm speaking with Damian Kulash, one of the founders of the band OK Go. They'll be at the Lewis Family Playhouse November 1st, more at lewisfamilyplayhouse.com, and more on the band at okgo.net. The Zero Gravity, we're talking about Upside Down and Inside Out, and this was one from the Hungry Ghosts. Now, this video, Zero Gravity on an Airplane, it looks like it's one continuous shot, and in a way it kind of is and isn't. Can you explain this, please, what I mean by that, just chopping out the section so it, in a way, was continuous, but also, if you could include, why did you have to go to Moscow to do this?
Well, we do most of our videos in a single take because that's how we wound up thinking about film as musicians. You know, none of us went to film school. None of us were thinking camera angles and whip pans when we started. We were just thinking about what type of event we could put on in front of the camera like you would in front of an audience. And so we always thought of the film in terms of what we, the participants in it, could be doing rather than what sort of tricks it could do to us. So as our ideas developed over the last decade, they've always kind of leaned on that feeling of realness. You know, like, what we want is for people not to see the filmmaking, but to see the event. We want them to be in the room with us. And the easiest way to kind of get that feeling is to minimize the number of edits, minimize the number of film tricks that kind of viscerally tell the viewer, oh, this isn't real. This is something that somebody put together in an edit bay somewhere. So we always try to do things as much like in real life as possible. Now, with a zero gravity plane, you only get 28 seconds of microgravity before it's time to pull up or hit the ground. So we obviously could only do this video in 28-second chunks. But what you can do is when you land, just sit perfectly still until the next parabola starts. And then you can speed ramp through that time so that it effectively, it's sort of like an edit. I mean, what you're really doing is jumping ahead in time a few minutes. So the video itself is basically a 45-minute plane flight boiled down to the 3.5 minutes of the song, removing the chunk where the plane is basically going from low altitude back up to high altitude so that you can do another free fall. And the reason we had to do this all in Russia was because the sponsor for the film was a Russian airline named S7. And as it turns out, it's good that we did it there, not only because the Russian zero-gravity plane is vastly more affordable than the U.S. one, but because it is wider. It's a wider, shorter plane, and so we had more room to choreograph our dance, which was nice.
They seem to be okay with you splattering it with paint as well.
Yes. I mean, what you see in the film is actually a set of an airplane that we built inside a real airplane, which is pretty meta and weird. Our process basically usually comes in kind of three stages. You know, we pick an idea that we're excited about, but we really don't know how we're going to complete. And then we play with facsimiles of that thing as best we can. In the case of the zero gravity thing, what that meant was we booked a third of our budget as flights where we just went up in the air and played. There was no real agenda other than put little cameras everywhere, capture everything that happens, and when we get down, we'll sort of sort through all of it and try to come up with a vocabulary of things that we think we can repeat as a dance routine. So we spent a full week just kind of bouncing off the walls of the empty plane, trying to figure out things like, should this look like it's a plane? Should this look like it's a room? What should this feel like? We settled on something of a split between the two. It felt like it was right to have it be an airplane, but we also wanted enough open space to do moves that couldn't fit between the overhead bin and the chairs. So inside this large military science craft, basically, we built a set of an airplane fuselage. You know, it's only 6 inches away from the edge of the real plane, basically. Mm. And in that space, we had a few rows of chairs and then a big open space we could play in. I mean, again, if you watch the behind-the-scenes stuff, you can sort of see this set crammed inside the real plane. It's funny, but it worked.
Yeah. Ever since my discovery, I've been trying to describe your sound to people, and electronica certainly doesn't cut it. It floats all over the place. I've been saying a bit of prog rock, a little bit of synth pop, if that were cool. There's an industrial sound sometimes, this close to a Trent Reznor kind of thing, but really, I guess electronics and keyboards maybe ties the whole thing in together. The point of this is that when the four of you started producing, and I know this is a bit of a different lineup than these days, but you really were not following anyone else's palette, were you?
No, I mean, to the extent we were, it was Queen, or we all grew up on the Pixies and The Cure and 80s pop. I mean, we were children born in the late 70s, and so Prince was a big effect on our youths, and Nirvana was a big effect on our high school years. But by the time we were finishing college, I think we had all kind of tired of just angsty, angry guitar music, but still very much thought of ourselves as people who played in rock bands. So our earliest stuff was very straight-ahead kind of guitar-based drum stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's just the sort of contrarian in us, but at that moment, what was happening in pop culture was like rap metal and kind of retro hipster rock and roll. And aesthetically, myself, I much prefer the retro hipster rock and roll. But we didn't want to be another The Strokes or The White Stripes. We sort of felt like the only thing that was missing from that world was the sort of pure joy of the Cars, you know, like overproduction in its most glorious form, you know. So our first record, there are guitar tracks on there where you're hearing upwards of 20 guitars playing the exact same line just to see what type of sound we could get out of it. On the second record, we tried to play everything live. Mm. There were no click tracks and everything was sort of all done in the same room at the same time. Our third and fourth record, there's a lot more programming and there's a lot much broader sonic palette. And that, I think, comes from the fact that the videos did a good job of shaking us loose from any kind of impression of ourselves. You know, when you're on a major label and you're 22 years old and you are trying to figure out how to make a living out of this, it's very, very hard not to be affected by what's on the radio or what people think you are. You know, like your first big single sounds like the Pixies. Well, you try to write another Pixies song.
But yeah, yeah.
After a few years, when the one thing you've done that really caught the attention of the world was the weirdest thing, it was us dancing on treadmills that had no precedent. And, you know, it was the one thing we did that which truly only we would do. You really, really should not be trying to rein your creative impulses in. You know, it doesn't mean that every idea you have is great, but it does mean that when I write a little soul song, instead of going, hey, this is nice, but it doesn't really sound like OK Go, I should just chase it and see where it goes. And a lot of them don't go anywhere. You know, I mean, we write lots of stuff that we never wind up happy with, but it has led us to be a lot more open with our sonic palette and think about music in a much more kind of boundless way. It also makes it very hard to describe what we sound like because even we're not sure.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows are at iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Coming up November 1st at Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga, OK Go. With many low-budget yet incredibly thought-out and in-depth music videos behind them, well, we'll hear about a couple more. You'll hear about tunes involving many trained dogs, and separately, an incredibly complex Rube Goldberg machine, timed out to their music. Since you mentioned you had an endorsement of sorts from the Russian plane company, no collusion, you also had a deal with Chevrolet. We're talking about one called Needing Getting. You can go to YouTube and just go, OK Go Car, and you'll get this one. The song is Needing Getting. Tell me about this as far as the song existed, but then there was a deal with Chevrolet, or were you guys goofing around in the desert? You created this, that got their attention. Tell me this whole deal. And this ended up getting a premiere on the Super Bowl. That's really cool as well.
So the Needing Getting video is one where I stunt drive a car through a desert obstacle course made of homemade instruments. And there's a robotic arm on the car so that as we are spinning around within this obstacle course, that arm is hitting these various instruments in time. The video is actually a live recording of the song done in this ridiculous way. And it was towards the end of the album cycle. You know, we were headed back to the studio to make our next record, and I guess this would have been 2011 or so. We got a call from a friend who worked at Chevy's ad agency and said, we're planning a whole bunch of weird stunts with cars, and I know you love doing ridiculous things. Do you want to pitch any ideas? I came up with three or four different things. I was like, I would love to do a musical obstacle course. I would love to do, and then we came up with one sentence ideas, and it turned out they really loved one of them, and so we started talking to them about how to do it, and Chevy got on board, and so we got to make this totally absurd and wonderful music video, and I got to take stunt driving lessons, which was really, really fun. And it turned into their Super Bowl commercial. It was not planned for it, but I think once they had recorded their high production fancy ads and then our weird low production ad, it turned out they liked ours more than the other one. So they aired it on the Super Bowl. And the music, of course, did exist in advance of that video. It was a thing we had started doing the album before, which was recording live versions of songs as if they are a music video. We thought people would respond to it as like a whole new weird art form, but it turns out they just respond to them as music videos. Like, we did a video for our song, This Too Shall Pass, with the Notre Dame marching band, who are all camouflaged in a field and emerge one by one to join us playing the song. And we thought, like, this is going to be so fun. People will be so amazed by this live performance of the song. And everybody just treated it like it was the video to that song. We're like, you know, the album version of this is all like distorted organs and like blown up drums. It doesn't sound anything like a marching band. But to the world, the visual is all, I guess, and they're sort of like, that's the video for this song.
It is really a separate experience. How does this one come across on stage when you're out performing clubs or whatnot? That's a good one to talk about since it is so drastically different between video and how it appears on the disc. When you're on stage with some of these songs, are you doing very much the straightforward four guys up there playing the instruments, or do you have all these wonderful percussive elements hidden around the stage?
Well, there's a few different versions of our live show. Sometimes we perform just like a rock band. Right now, we are having a great deal of fun doing something that's not really a rock show at all. We call it our live video show. It's really a theater performance. What we do is we screen the videos, like full movie theater style, but we play along with them live. So we're up on stage playing along with the videos, and when it comes to the weirder songs with the weirder instruments, we bring out those crazy instruments and recreate it on stage. Of course, we can't drive a car around in the theater.
Right.
But it was really a very different experience. You know, they're very family-friendly shows. They're always in sit-down performing arts spaces, and, you know, so they're comfortable, and they're kid-friendly, and they're friendly for audiences that are older. And we found it just, like, so much fun to perform this way because there's a lot of question and answer with the audience. We spend a lot of time answering people's questions about how the videos were made. We do some of the dances from the videos. We have songs that have interactive elements where the audience can play along with us. I mean, it's barely connected to the idea of a concert, and it's much more of a theater show than it is a traditional rock concert. So we've been having a great time, and I know we'll be in your area doing that one soon. That's the one that we'll be playing near you.
Good, good. That would be the one that I'd be looking forward to. I like the music, but I love this other element that you've just been speaking about. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. I'm speaking with Damian Kulash, one of the founders of the band OK Go. They'll be at the Lewis Family Playhouse November 1st. More at lewisfamilyplayhouse.com. And more on the band at okgo.net. Another incredible video. Now, I thought that this was This Too Shall Pass, so maybe I'm mistaken. I'm looking at the one with the Rube Goldberg machine.
It is. We have two videos for that song and for two different versions of that song. You're right. When we were coming up with videos for that album, which is called Of the Blue Color of the Sky, we had a long list of ideas of things we wanted to try visually, and one of them was this far-fetched idea with the Notre Dame marching band, and another was this far-fetched idea making a Rube Goldberg machine that could run in time to the song, and sort of like, you know, we're trying to make physics do a dance, basically. And both of them seemed like, you know, less than 50% chance we'd get to do it, probably less than a 5% chance we'd get to do it. So when we were putting together the ideas, we just tried to figure out which songs they fit best to, not distribute them across the album in some kind of like promotional maximalist way.
Sure,
and
sure.
It just turned out that that song made those two ideas feel right. So we kept chasing the idea, expecting that one of those things would fall through, and in the end, both of them happened. So we wound up with two videos for two different versions of the song, and it was really fun.
Wow.
The video, the one you're talking about, the Rube Goldberg machine video, was the first time I really worked with a real film crew as a director. Like, you know, we'd had high-level directors do fancy label videos for us prior to that. But all of our videos that we've made before that were basically just us and a handful of friends, you know, like a friend from college or my sister, or, you know, it's like there was never more than five people in the room kind of thing. That video took dozens of engineers working with us and a very, very experienced film crew, and it was the first time I had directed anything like that. James Frost, who's a director and a friend, co-directed it with me, so I wasn't completely flying blind. But I have to say, looking back on it, now having directed a lot more since then, I'm sort of lucky I didn't know what a crazy cliff we were walking off of. It's unbelievable that that wound up working. I mean, mathematically speaking, it should have taken 10 or 20 years to get that to accidentally work, and we managed to get it in 2.5 days. We were very, very, very lucky, and I still get this weird anxiety when I watch it. I mean, it's like this real sense of joy when we get to the end and pan up and you see the whole crew that was working there, including like my mom and my dad, who were, staying up all night with us, trying to get the marble to roll down the track the right way.
Oh, sure, yeah. As we are an NPR station, and we do air This American Life, this is a severe jump in time, but talk about how you came to the attention of Ira Glass and was even invited to be the house band for some of the live shows that they would do.
Yeah, well, I was a radio engineer at NPR in Chicago. I worked for the NPR Bureau in Chicago when it existed. Now all the news is done through BEZ, but NPR used to have its own separate bureau there, and I was one of the house engineers, and my girlfriend at the time was the director of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and so our friends, you know, like our whole social set was basically people from WBEZ and the Chicago NPR scene, and so Ira had heard my band, and when they were going on their fifth anniversary live tour, it seemed like they had been around forever because they had been there for 5 years, and that's now 20 years ago. They invited us to be their house band, so we were mostly playing bed music behind their live show with a couple of performances here and there as they went to commercial breaks and that kind of stuff. And it was actually Ira who convinced us to start doing our ridiculous dance routines on stage. No. He had seen this crazy thing we did for a public access TV station in Chicago before we'd recorded even a second song. We had one song recorded, and this TV show asked us to come on and lip-sync to it. And we were like, well, if we're going to lip-sync, we're going to swing for the fences. So we came up with a ridiculous dance routine, and that's where this whole OK Go as dancers thing started. So Ira had seen that and said, I really want you to do that on stage in front of this American Life audience. And I was like, Ira, it's radio. They can't see us dancing. And he was like, no, it's theater. Don't worry. I got the radio part. You do this. Wow. And so at Town Hall in New York, we did that dance on stage for the first time in front of an audience. And it totally slayed. And we realized, like, that's the type of joy we wish we could get into a rock show. So we started doing it in our rock shows. And the rest is history.
Beautiful. Damien, before I wrap, I just have a note, the dog show.
Yeah, the dog video is White Knuckles. That was on the eve of us performing the treadmill dance on the VMAs in 2007, it probably was. You know, it was like the height of MTV VMAs, and we were invited to do our treadmill dance live with Beyonce sitting in the front row, and we were nervous as you could possibly imagine and sort of freaking out, but also realizing this is that weird moment we're having right now. Like, this only comes once in a lifetime when people actually care about this ridiculous thing we're doing. So now is the moment when you come up with your next most ridiculous idea and tell people, this is what I want. You know, when they say, what are you doing next? You say this. And in that moment, we were like, you know what? Next time we're doing a dance with dogs. It turned out it took us more than 5 years to actually make the dance with dogs, because finding the right dog trainer and the budget to make it is easier said than done. But we did wind up getting to make a one-take video in which we choreograph to dance with dogs. It's 14 dogs and 12 trainers, and it's all one take. And, you know, dogs can do amazing things on film as long as you keep it down to 15 seconds. In that 15 seconds, they could do your taxes, but don't expect them to do anything for a minute and a half. You know, their attention span just isn't like that. So getting them to do a 3.5-minute choreography meant most of their dancing is like sit, stand, jump. But we wanted to see if we could make that work, and I think we did. It's a pretty fun video.
You did mention, so what are you doing next? And so I guess I need to ask you, so what are you doing next? Your newest disc is 5 years old. Are you writing for a new release, or maybe Strange and Wonderful concept videos coming up?
Yes, all of the above. Both the guitarist in the band and myself have had children recently, so we took some time off to be stay-at-home dads. And we are now recording again. We have a whole bunch of new music, and we have a big lineup of videos we'd like to be making. We have painted ourselves into a bit of a corner that they're so complicated now that we can't do them on our own budget, and we almost always need a sponsor. Luckily, sponsors are much more into these ideas than they were 5 or 10 years ago, but not everybody has that kind of money to spend on a music video. So we're looking for the right sponsors, we're recording music, and my wife and I are working on a feature film about the late 90s. It's about the moment when America thought that what they should invest their time, energy, and money into was Beanie Babies.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's a weird and wonderful film, and we hope to be shooting it this spring or summer. So we're working on the record, we're working on the movie, and we'll see which one gets finished first.
It's been music from OK Go and conversation with one of the co-founders, Damien Kulash. OK Go will be at the Lewis Family Playhouse November 1st. More at lewisfamilyplayhouse.com and more on the band at okgo.net. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks again to Damien Kulash and to Phil Frandina with Upward Spiral Music. Thanks also to Dodie Stevens and to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions. More on the concert with Dodie Stevens and many more at affordablemusicproductions.com. Here at KBCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Lillian Vasquez, Sharina Wadd, and Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KBC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year at kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.